While you are busy enjoying your lunch, while you are busy having some times from 1300 hours, take time and listen to OTR News Bulletin.
On the radio news analysis, we go beyond the headlines. We don't just tell you what's happening. We ask why it's happening, how it affects ordinary Namibians, and what it means for the country's future. We examine the structures behind news, connect policy to people's lived realities, and bring in expert voices to make sense of where Namibia is heading.
You want to get into touch with global governance, global diplomacy, economic relations, trade, statistics, human and infrastructure development, and you want to see how policy planning and policy implementation is connected in Namibia. Make time and listen to OTR from 1300 hours to 1430 with Happy Juju.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Good afternoon, Namibia. This right here is On the Reading News Analysis on Eagle FM. I'm your host, Ndafa Happy Juju. In a period where public trust, economic resilience, and institutional accountability are under sharper focus than ever, the value of clear thinking and credible information cannot be overstated. Every weekday from 1300 hours to 1430, we step beyond the surface of the headlines to examine the structural forces shaping our nation. From fiscal policy and public expenditure to governance reforms and service delivery performance, because understanding the direction of our economy requires more than reaction, it requires reflection. Now across Namibia, from the policy corridors of Windhoek to the fishing hubs off the coast, the agricultural heartlands in the north and the towns of the south, citizens are asking important questions. Are public resources being allocated efficiently? Are development plans translating into visible change? Are institutions responding effectively to the needs of the people? Now today, we take a deliberate pause to interrogate how national priorities move from legislation to implementation, how budget figures transform into classrooms, clinics and roads, and how economic indicators ultimately reflect or fail to reflect the lived realities of many Namibians. Now, right here on the Reader, On the Reader platform is not just a platform for noise. It's not a platform for noise. It is a space for measured, balanced, and solution-driven dialogue. Here, experts, policymakers, analysts, trade analysts, economists, and engaged citizens meet on common ground. That is evidence. We believe a rigorous debate strengthens democracy when it is informed, respectful, and anchored in the facts. Now, as Namibia navigates complex economic choices and heightened public expectations, we remain committed to one principle, that is clarity in conversation, which leads to credibility in governance. So stay tuned as we unpack the issues shaping our development path thoughtfully, responsibly, and without distraction. This is On the Reader. Let's get right into today's conversation. Namibia has reaffirmed its commitment to economic diversification and value addition in the extractive sector with the launch of a new report titled Rapid Assessment of Value Addition and Diversification Within and Beyond the Critical Energy Transition Mineral Value Chain. Now, speaking at the launch, Namibia's Minister of International Relations and Trade, Selma Ashipala Musavi, said the report aligns with the 8th administration's development theme adopted by the president, that is President Tumwinandi Ndaitwe, unity in diversity, natural resources beneficiation, and youth empowerment for sustainable development. Now, the report was prepared with technical support from the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development with financial assistance from the government of Japan. Now, Minister Selma Ashipala Musavi emphasized that while Namibia's extractive sector remains vital, the country must move beyond exporting raw materials. She said the growing global demand for critical energy transition minerals represents a strategic opportunity to promote beneficiation, strengthen local industrial linkages, and create employment. And I quote, the measure of our success must be reflected not only in export volumes, but in the depth of domestic participation across value chains, she noted. Now, the report outlines practical pathways for enhancing industrial development, building specialized skills, and expanding market access for Namibian products. Now, the minister stressed that diversification efforts must extend beyond large-scale industries to include small and medium enterprises, what is known as SMEs, which are key drivers of innovation, of employment and inclusive growth. Now, she highlighted Namibia's economic policy under the 8th administration is anchored in fiscal stability, increased investment and expansion of productive capacity. Namibia's participation in regional and continental trade platforms, which of course the minister has been participating a lot in since she took up her office, and I've come to realize this is one of the ministries that really engages with outside, hence why it's called international and trade. Now, continental trade platforms such as the Southern African Development Community, that is SADC, and the Southern African Customs Union, that is SACU, and the African Continental Free Trade Area, that is AFCFTA, was cited as critical to scaling production and accessing larger markets. The minister said strengthening intra-African trade would support regional manufacturing, attract investment, and foster competitive industries, no doubt about that. Now, referring to Namibia's 6th National Development Plan launched in July 2025, Minister Selma Chipala-Musavi stressed the importance of investing natural resource revenues into sustainable development and livelihood improvement. She underscored that the real impact of the UNCTAD assessment would depend on how effectively its recommendations are incorporated into national planning, into investment strategies, and as well as into implementation mechanisms. Now, the Ministry of International Relations and Trade reaffirmed its commitment to advancing industrialization, structural transformation, and expanded participation in regional and global value chains. So the minister also concluded by urging stakeholders to treat the report as a strategic roadmap for Namibia's economic transformation and long-term prosperity. Now let's take a listen to Minister Selma Chipala-Musavi, and then another voice for another person actually comes in to speak on value addition in this report as well. Let's take a listen.
The 8th administration, Her Excellency Dr. Netumbo Nandi-Ndaitwah, President of the Republic of Namibia, has adopted the theme Unity in Diversity, Beneficiation of Natural Resources, and Youth Empowerment for Sustainable Development. Therefore, the launch of the report on the rapid assessment of value addition and diversification within and beyond the critical energy transition mineral value chain is an actualization of the theme of the 8th administration, and I am truly delighted to be here this morning. In the same vein, I extend sincere appreciation to the UN Conference on Trade and Development, UNCTAD, for its continued support and partnership that has culminated in us convening this important engagement. I shall be remiss if I do not express Namibia's deepest thanks and appreciation to the government of Japan for its generous financial support towards the preparation of this timely report, as it has been alluded to. Thank you very much, Japan. Productive capacity. Like many African economies, Namibia historically has been characterized as an extractive economy. And while the extractive sector remains vital, and I want to stress this, we do not underestimate this extractive sector. We believe that we must, however, avoid being perpetually confined to a model based predominantly on the export of raw materials. In line with our aspiration of Vision 2030 and the aspirations of the Africa we want. The evidence presented in this report places emphasis on the fact that there are practical and achievable pathways to move beyond this status of exporting raw materials. In particular, the growing global demand for energy transition and minerals present a strategic opportunity. By promoting beneficiation and strengthening local linkages, we can enhance industrial development, create employment, build specialized skills, and secure greater market access for Namibia's products and services. The measure of our success must be reflected not only in export volumes, but in the depth of domestic participation
and proposes targeted policies to close these gaps. It answers not just what could Namibia produce, but what exactly needs to change for Namibia to produce it. And Namibia already have a very good base to start. The 6th National Development Plan, the Minerals Beneficiation Strategy, the Special Economic Zones, the Port of Walvis Base, a bay connecting the country to global and regional corridors. These are real assets. This report connects them to specific products, specific markets, and specific investment opportunities. Think of it as a GPS for industrial policy.
Now, the launch of this document is quite a very important, of course, as in anything that has to be implemented. Policy implementation always, obviously, is better implemented with evidence-based information. Now, let's talk about what Namibia could do right now to materialize a value addition and actually make it bring it to life. And Namibia stands at a strategic crossroad with rising global demand for critical energy transition minerals. Now, the country has an opportunity to move from being primarily an exporter of raw materials to becoming a competitive producer of higher value goods, which means more money into our economy. Now, to materialize a value addition in a sustainable and inclusive manner, Namibia must pursue coordinated action across policy, infrastructure, skills development, finance, and regional integration. And I highlight the coordinated action because if Namibia obviously focuses on only one aspect, let's say, for instance, they focus on the aspect of infrastructure. We get all the machinery, everything that is needed for us to execute value addition across all sectors of our economy. Yet, we do not ensure that the people are well, properly skilled. We don't enhance on skills development. We don't deliberately send people out there to get the necessary skills, whether it's to different countries, or get those that have the skills to come and train our people right here at home, which I would obviously think that would be probably more cheaper to get one person than to send about 10 people to go to another country. You have to live there. You have to feed them, of course, and that's plane tickets and all that and all that. Now, value addition does not happen automatically, neither does it happen overnight. Of course, it requires deliberate policy direction. Namibia could develop and implement a clear national beneficiation strategy that is aligned with its industrial policy, what our policies are. Of course, keeping in mind an environmental policy or other policies that are on the table that then come to play. Now, also, we could introduce predictable regulatory frameworks that incentivize local processing without discouraging investment. Also using fiscal tools such as tax incentives, which we have done. I do remember the president speaking about, let me not even say the percentage, but yeah, export levies on raw materials, on raw minerals where appropriate, and local content requirements carefully, obviously, but yet strategically. We could also ensure policy certainty to attract long-term capital investment. We need to give them tangible results, should I say? Something that obviously you say, what are the investors going to benefit from us? Without taking away a big chunk of what we are supposed to benefit from. Now, so policy coherence across ministries, such as the mining, the trade, the finance, energy, and education, is essential to avoid fragmentation. Industrialization or investment in processing and industrial infrastructure. Now, industrialization depends heavily on infrastructure readiness. And I do remember one day speaking about it, we need to buy the machinery. If we're talking about value addition requires machinery. It requires machineries for processing, requires the machineries that are needed to make a certain product, to turn it into a finished product. It requires infrastructure. Therefore, Namibia needs to prioritize on reliable and affordable electricity supply, particularly for mineral processing plants and the expansion of water infrastructure, given the high water intensity of mineral processing, as well as upgrading logistics system, which included ports, the rail and the road networks. Now, of course, we're already strategically positioned when we're talking about the Walvis Bay port or Walvis Bay hub. Now, the development of industrial parks or special economic zones focus on mineral beneficiation. And another thing about industrial parks, this should not be concentrated in the capital city. They should be strategically located as well in the rural communities, but it depends on what industrialization is going to be taking place at that particular place. For instance, if we're talking about value addition for agro-processing, then I think it would be convenient to place one to place some in Tumeb, to place some far in the north, and to place some far as Zambezi regions and the Kavango East and West, because that's where we're talking about. When we're talking about agro-processing, of course, we can't forget those regions as they are known as Namibia's fruit basket. Now, on building technical and specialized skills, value addition requires more than natural resources. It requires human capital. It requires the human resources. So Namibia could strengthen technical and vocational education and training. I know we have consistently been talking about TVET, and of course TVET now receiving as well funds and NSFAF for the students who are going to TVET. We really need to invest more in creating awareness for the young ones themselves to really see a need and a desire and to see a job opportunity after their graduation, not as it's something that they could easily get and not as a struggle. Why? Because Namibia is talking, we're talking about industrialization. We're talking about value addition. We're talking about wanting to create our own things right here at home. So at this point, from how I've interacted with people in the fields as I have, I noticed it is obvious that we are moving towards agriculture. We're moving towards vocational, technical. That's the line we're moving now to. Of course, we're not going to discourage those who want to go and do nursing and education. But then again, it is also requires now awareness, a change of a mindset to say, if you're noticing that about 500 nurses, qualified nurses, show up for one post, one nursing post, somewhere or in the government, as was done somewhere last year, then we need to get them into a mindset or a habit of taking on other fields that are not so dominated, that were often overlooked, but are very critical at this particular point in time for our economy, for the development and the moving forward of Namibia's economy. So it's a good thing to actually listen and take note and align oneself with where the world is going. The world is going industrialization, obviously, where we're actually trying to get to now. So yeah, awareness in terms of that, strengthening technical and vocational education and training is one of them. Investing in mining engineering, and we have a scheduled commercial break coming up. But let's take that one, and we'll be back shortly to continue right with this particular news.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually...
Fall in love with the best prices at WB. Get 500 gram Bokomo cornflakes for $31.99. 2 kg nice rice for only $34.99. 1.5 kg real good mixed chicken portions for $79.99. And 10 kg Bokomo fat cook flour for just $137.99. See more February specials at furmanbrock.com. We care.
Expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that does not have capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I am planning an event for next weekend, and I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back. Now continuing our conversation on how Namibia can actually achieve value addition. We left off with, we're speaking about investing in mining. Okay, investing in mining engineering, in metallurgy, in chemical processing and renewable energy technologies. And I think Namibia has done quite well in this aspect. We have a lot of mining, we have some engineering students. I do remember so long time ago when I was in high school, when young girls also and boys were being encouraged to take up engineering, because back then it was seen as We need to move into engineering so we can engineer our own things right here in the land of the brave. And so I would want to say that I don't know how exactly how far we've gone and how much we've done specifically, but I can say that we've done well in terms of producing our own engineers. So I think that's a matter of just that one is somehow somewhat sorted, but then it's a matter of bringing them on board to actually help in this aspect. Now also to promote partnership between universities, between research institutions and industry. Now that's a big one. Promoting a partnership between the universities, between research institutions, research and the universities, research institutions and universities usually one, unlike in other places where it's different. And here, so we do have some research institutions, but usually a university has it has a research institution. Now, promoting partnership with this one, with the industry. Now, there has been, of course, universities sending students for internships. That has become now a thing in the recent years. Back then, it wasn't really a thing. You finish the 4-year degree, you finish your 3-year degree, and go on into go look for a job. But now, before you do look for a job, it is where they have now introduced, obviously, going for job attachment, where you are introduced into the industry. So I guess that one it could work by universities sending students into the industry to actually learn. We'll talk about another day how industries could also help finance those students. Now, also as well, encouraging technology transfer agreements in foreign direct investment or FDI contracts. A skilled workforce should ensures that value addition generates domestic employment rather than relying heavily on imported expertise. One thing about value addition, when I believe those that talk about in the leadership that talk about value addition, as much as we want to be proud of saying this is our homemade rice and Namibians love it and are running towards that, as much as we want to say this is Namibia's own pasta polane and we take pride in that and a lot of Namibians consume that, as much as we are saying this is our own top score and Namibia is proud of that and almost every household consumes top score and other Namib meals or whatsoever, yeah? Not trying to promote any, so I want to be very neutral. Another aspect that we might be overlooking, which is as well very important when we're talking about value addition, is that it has the capacity to create employment. Value addition has the capacity to create employment. Because before you get a top score, before you get that there has to be maize. There has to be a farmer who then has to produce maize for us. And then has to be those who are going to harvest the maize. And then there has to be those ones that are sorting out. Then there has to be. So it's a process of things. And this requires people at home. So the whole process from the planting of the seed to the very last product of the maize coming into your house, all that requires people, that requires labor, that requires human capital, human resources, and all those things would now bring in, since every part has its person to play its part, it now brings in people. This is where we're talking about employment and actually absorbing the people into the industry. And therefore, it has a great capacity to create employment. So diversification, which the president has spoken about, must include small and medium enterprises, and of which the government and the industry can facilitate supplier development programs to integrate SMEs into mining value chains, and of course other areas of value addition. also improve access to finance through development banks and credit guarantees, which are easily accessible to small and medium enterprises where collateral is not so a difficult thing for them to access. And also where documents, as much as, of course, there needs to be documentation, where they are not overloaded with documents, that they won't be able to access the finances because they can't find particular documents or they are not able to get hold of certain documents. And as well as support innovation hubs and entrepreneurship programs, which I've come to notice that a couple of Namibians are coming up with innovation hubs and, of course, entrepreneurship programs. Those are things that we will need to look to and help boost them as well, and encourage procurement policies that favor competitive local firms. Inclusive participation therefore reduces economic vulnerability and spreads the benefits of industrialization. Namibia should not industrialize in isolation, definitely, and I believe that we are doing quite well also by engaging outsiders such as the Southern African Development Community, that is SADC, and the Southern African Customs Union, SACU, and the Africa Continental Free Trade Area, of which Namibia has already launched the document now and has been doing stakeholder engagements towards the end of the year, especially in making them understand and how they can actually participate and play their part in the African Continental Free Trade Area, so they can actually expand market access for our processed goods, and this will also help reduce tariff and non-tariff barriers, and it will help enable cross-border broader industrial value chains and attract investors seeking regional production hubs. And this regional cooperation can also help strengthen bargaining power in the global supply chains. So on strengthening environmental and social governance, sustainable beneficiation is critical in a carbon-contained world or constrained world. Namibia could enforce environmental standards in mineral processing. Yes, we do have some of those documents that are there as a guider. Implementation of them also is another thing. And hearing from an environmental expert the other time is that some environmentalists actually overlook certain things for beneficiation or for side door benefit, but then overlooking that you're selling away our environment, which will then harm us in the long run, harm the generation to come in the long run. So investing in renewable energy in order to power industrial operations is also another thing, and promoting secular economic practices, which include recycling of critical minerals and ensuring community participation and benefit sharing mechanisms. Therefore, there's a need for responsible industrialization enhancement and investor confidence and international market access. Now, an effective implementation, we can't overlook that, requires strong institutions. So institutional efficiency determines whether value addition policies succeed in real practice. For Namibia, value addition is not merely an economic ambition. It is a development imperative. And moving beyond raw material exports can create jobs, can deepen industrial capacity, can strengthen resilience against commodity price shocks, and enhance physical stability. However, success depends on deliberate planning, on policy consistency, on investment in infrastructure and skills, and regional integration, rural communities, and strong governance. Now, if these actions are pursued strategically and cohesively together with collaborating between stakeholders, Namibia can transform its resource endowment into sustainable industrial growth and long-term prosperity. And we will definitely not just be singing the song, but we would rather be benefiting from it. That is value addition in so many sectors. But I do believe that looking forward, probably 5 years from now, we will have tangible items that we will point to and say, this is what Namibia did in terms of value addition. Because when something is enhanced and awareness is created for it, there will be few people who are really hands-on, practical, who will really will get the vision and run with it and bring in people and get the skills that they need. And actually, we will be looking at the chefs when you go actually in a supermarket and you have, and on the chefs, you have so a variety of so many Namibian products, proudly Namibian, you know. So just as we normally see a lot of South African products, I believe that it is attainable. And also with the launch of this document, I believe Namibia is just a few steps away from actually seeing this come to life. Now, of course, let's take a pause right here, take a trip to the marketplace. We'll be back with more. Stay tuned right here on the Reader News Analysis. Now, should you be interested in partaking, also 083-288-401 is the number in studio. I hardly see calls, but you are more than welcome to dial in. 083-288-401 is the number in studio. Remember, this is on the Reader News Analysis, Eagle FM, which gives you the platform to engage and share opinions and contributions. You just never know. You might be sitting on a gold mine that you actually await, that awaits, where the world awaits to hear from you. Stay tuned.
Lipura nengeno wapumbwa Eva tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nwe kudite ofoye ekukurile oshafa fana nongeshefa ili mehola mo iho etike kovano hile koshiwana onongeshefa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi tota njuka okukwetira oipindi konu konda doi inawa nune udo otukwetira o special angeta shake ngeshefa omarudi tayo loka opone ushendi fenawa nokumona oijamo ili nawa ninge pata fanona Monica ko Eagle FM onora itatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali ile konderewa nora hetatu natu bali o hetatu watatu omafilane Eagle FM the eye.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually...
Why pay more when you can pay less at USave stores? Enjoy nutritious and delicious meals for the whole family. 2 kilogram real good frozen mixed chicken portions for only 99.99 Namibian dollars. 3 kilos Polana pasta, just 74.99 Namibian dollars. 500 grams of Romy 37% fat spread, just 14.99 Namibian dollars. 700 milliliter crystal gold tomato sauce, just 24.99 Namibian dollars. USave, where good food costs less.
Of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
So not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You're the person who doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye. Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
So not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You're the person who doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6%, is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye. The eye.
Welcome back. Yesterday on Thursday, the 19th of February, the Minister of Education, Innovation, Youth, Sports, Arts and Culture, Dr. Sanet Steenkamp, gave a public lecture on celebrating academic achievement at NUST, Let's take a listen to what she had to say, and we will be back to debunk on that.
Ladies and gentlemen, the journey of turbulence and transformation. On the screen, you will see notebooks. Those notebooks, I kept some for research purposes, and I kept some for the purpose of reflexivity. Reflecting right after an interview that I've done, or reflecting after I've done a data analysis, what it did to me, what it did to my emotions, how did it make me feel. It was also the notebooks in which I captured sometimes handwritten notes about seminal authors and going back to them. Now, this journey, PhD, did not start in 2018. Officially, it kick-started in 2018. But I did my master's at the Rhodes University in the year 2000. And then 2 years later, I graduated. Educational Leadership and Management, Inclusive Education. I looked at Gabriel Tapopi and the integration of visually impaired learners and what we need to do. And then for years, I did not study, but I read. And then in 2013, I went to the Rhodes University, and I then got into a pre-doc. I went there for a week, Dr. Simata, and I just wanted to understand, am I right for this journey? Believe you me, I end up crying in the bathroom. When I listen to all these theories, and I'm so out of touch, and I don't understand, and I'm asking myself in that bathroom, is this really what you want to do? With all these theories, research methodologies, you have to find your niche. Which theory will it be? You see, and I was just overwhelmed. But then I decided I'm here for a purpose. I want to do my PhD. So I enrolled in 2015 and became then also the executive director or the permanent secretary. Then I had to put the study on hold for 2 years. 2017, my lecturer then went on retirement, and I had to change lecturers and I had to change topics. But I found my niche. I read in 2018, I read for 1 full year for my proposal. 1 full year I just did reading. And then I wrote the proposal in 3 weeks' time, and it was adopted because somehow I internalized it. And the reading assisted me to do that. So it was really a difficult journey, but deeply enlightening and very, very rewarding. You can't do it without the love and support of your family. And I want to also thank my sister and a daughter, my own daughter who's here present. Thank you very much. All family members, all loved ones, all the students and scholars and everybody listening to me. Thank you. It was a daily balancing between the call of scholarship and leadership. It was about the policy documents that are competing with chapters that had to be written, and also skillful decision making during the day and at night, putting your student hat on and just sit there and get it out and write. So it can't be attained without sleepless nights, a shift in priorities, and also profound reflection. So it's a dual identity. As it was said, I was full-time employed in government service as an executive director. I already talked about the academia and the governance and the balancing of power and openness that you cannot take away, because I worked with teachers. There was the element of power that I had to address. And then the teachers were selected out of their own. If the participants are here tonight, I really want to honor these teachers from two schools, Morrison School for Intellectual Impairment, and I will tell you why we named the schools, and Dagbreek School for Intellectual Impairment. So it was deeply personal to me. My goal that I wrote in Afrikaans in 2017 was very simple. I said I will read for my thesis, or for my studies, I will do the studies, conduct the studies, and I will write up the thesis. I'm telling you, it wasn't like that. But that was my goal, and in the end, I achieved it. And I still have that written note. So, what was my title? My title looked at expanding the leadership of learning support teachers in resource schools. We don't call these schools special needs schools anymore, or special schools. We call them resource schools. And Dr. Aune will know from UNICEF. We call them resource schools because they serve as a resource for other mainstream schools. So the goal was, it was also a formative intervention study that was done. So the goal was to expand on teacher leadership for inclusive practices. The challenge and the problem that I saw is that many of our teachers in the teaching profession, special educational needs, are undermined, underestimated, and really underrecognized and undervalued. And they do a phenomenal and extraordinary work. And I knew within them there were some teacher leaders, and I wanted to determine how can we expand on the teacher leadership. So those were I had three activity systems. It was the Ministry of Education Head Office, NEET and Programs and Quality Assurance, Dagbreek and Morrison. And I started in 2017 with gaining access to the schools, presenting what I want to do, getting teachers, talking them through and getting their buy-in until they were readily and voluntarily joining the study. So I did it in two phases. First phase was contextual profiling of current practices. It took me 6 months. The first question that I looked into is, how do the learning support teachers actually lead in the resource schools? Because I knew there was elements of leadership there. The second question focused, what are the enabling but also constraining factors and mechanisms of teacher leadership in the current resource schools, there where they were. And then after that, after analyzing their data, it was data it was document analysis, and then it was interviews, it was focus group discussions, I moved on to the next stage. But on every step, the teachers were with me. I went back to the schools, I went back to the school management, I gave them feedback, mirror the data. This is what I found. Do you agree with it? How do we move forward? What do we take from here as key elements that you wish to work on as teachers? So that was the first 6 months. I then followed it through with a formative intervention phase. Now, this is very interesting. That's why the study was not descriptive. It was actual action. And in the second phase, which took one full year, just with the teachers alone, nothing to do with the write-up, just with the teachers alone, how can the leadership of learning support teachers be expanded to enhance inclusive practices, but also build the capacity of teachers within their schools, but also across with other schools? So that was the key thing, the third question in terms of the research. COVID then came. And the very day on the 20th of March that I was supposed to have the first intervention workshop was the day also that the schools closed and where we said everyone is going home and we cannot have any grouping or any gatherings. And that's why I started then, instead of March, September 2020, with the formative interventions. So what was my theoretical framework? Really, it focused on third-generation CHAT. It's called Cultural Historical Activity Theory. I think the scholars and the academics will know about it. See, some are smiling. And it was ideal for me. It's practice-based, it's future-oriented, and it's really a framework that actively looked at intervening to transform social conditions. It's about transformation. So it gave me the right tools, this theory, and the language to run with it. And it's a formative intervention, which means it's a participatory approach. It was not just to study the reality. I wanted to do something more. I wanted to have a transformation in the reality that we found. And I used boundary crossing laboratories, meaning a selection of teachers from across the two schools, who may or may not have ever worked with each other before, and also head office staff members for the first time worked in a collaborative space across professional borders, later on co-opting principals to reimagine their work and bring forth new design and change. So there are core concepts of contradictions. These are tensions that truly reveal where the systems need transformation. And sometimes these sessions were very emotive because of the contradictions that were emerging from the data. All the videos, the change laboratory or the boundary crossing laboratory, had to be video recorded. If they were 2 hours, you had to record them and you had to analyze every single line of dialogue and then I followed an expansive learning cycle, meaning, I will talk about it briefly, you look at learning that is not existing yet. So it's emerging from a collaborative space. And then, of course, key concepts for me was the issue of transformative agency of the teachers. It emerged by itself. It's not forced into the study. It means that the participants were taking initiative to drive change. And then there's a term, not working, which is really teasing out short-term and intense collaboration that professionals work with to solve real problems.
Okay. Now, Dr. Steenkamp's thesis was titled Expanding the Leadership of Learning Support, Teachers in Resource Schools, a Formative Intervention Study in Namibia. Let me repeat that again. Expanding the Leadership of Learning Support Teachers in Resource Schools, a Formative Intervention Study in Namibia. And it explored ways that help to strengthen leadership among teachers supporting learners with special needs. Now, as you heard the minister say there, that teachers who work with special needs children are really undermined, unrecognized, and are barely even noticed. Yet they are doing an incredible job. And I think until perhaps one has a child with special needs or has a neighbor has really come to in contact, in real close contact with a child with special needs, we take it for granted. We don't really appreciate them. So it's very necessary that we do that. If we're talking about inclusivity, we have to talk about it in every aspect, ensuring that really no Namibian is left out. And when we say no Namibian is left out, we're dealing with everybody. So which means we need to accommodate, and anything that needs to be done, whether it's non-special needs children, everything has to be incorporated. So it's an interesting study that the minister spoke about. One thing I would want to say is that while the minister was the deputy minister of education last year, I picked up that she's quite very effective or efficient in her work. So you can see almost as if somebody who's really passionate with education. No surprise that she was actually doing her PhD and prior to her being appointed as the minister of the now Minister of Education, Innovation, Youth, Sports, Arts and Culture. And it was in that very year also, she was appointed in March, and it was in, I believe, towards the end of the year that she then graduated her PhD, which is really what we need, you know. We need those who are leading us, especially in education, to set an example for us. And we need them also to be articulate, you know, if one is going to be in leadership position, and especially if we're talking about education, they need to articulate themselves in a manner that is clear and understandable. And they need to be accessible to the public as well, to be able to get hold of them and ask them certain questions. And they need to be able to answer those questions sometimes from the top of their head, not necessarily having to consult the ED or to consult somebody. Yes, that's necessary too. But the minister needs to understand and know what is going on within her ministry, because, hey, she is the head. She is the one leading it. So I think, with that being said, it's something that I really myself have been wanting to say out here, that Minister Sanet Tienkam is really living by example when you're talking about in terms of education. And I believe she has more to offer in terms of education to the Namibian education system. And I believe with time, we will be able to see those tangible results. But of course, let's pause right here now. This is on the Reader News Analysis 083-288-401. Is the number in studio. Please come through. Your opinions and contributions, ask questions right here. Let's pause here and we'll be back with news beyond the borders of Namibia. Stay tuned.
Lipura nengeno wapumbwa Eva Tero ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nweku dite opoye ekukurile oshafafana nongeshefa ili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshiwana onongeshefa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi tota enjuka okukwetira oipindi konu konda doi inawa nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshefa omarudi dayo loka opone ushendife nawa nokumona oijamo ili nawa ninge Fanona, Monica, Co, Eagle FM, Honora Tatime, Bali Heali, Nola Natu, Heali Bali, No Heali, Ileko, Berewa, Nora Hetatu Natu, Bali O Hetatu Watatu, Oma Felane, Eagle FM, the Eye.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who does not have capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Lipura nengeno wapumbwa Eva Tero ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nweku dite opoye ekukurile oshafafana nongeshefa ili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshiwana onongeshefa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi tota enjuka okukwetira oipindi konu konda doi inawa nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshefa omarudi dayo loka opone ushendife nawa nokumona oijamo ili nawa ninge pata fanona Monica ko Eagle FM onora etatuimwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali Ileko berewa nora hetatu natu bali o hetatu watatu oma felane Eagle FM the eye.
And now for news beyond the borders of Namibia, let's start off in South Africa regarding the Wits University protests with free education and its funding and underperforming students are being addressed.
We're now joined by the spokesperson of the university, Sharona Patel. Sharona, good evening. Thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. You've heard what Nkosinathi said there. And I want us to focus on the issue of the student debt first, that they claim resulted in the financial difficulties students are facing currently with not being able to register. Is it indeed true, as Nkosinathi paints it, that the allocation that comes from the National Student Financial Aid Scheme for accommodation is capped at 52,000 rand, but on average, students have to pay more than 71,000 rand for on-campus residence accommodation. Is that the case?
So there is a gap. Thank you, Oliver, and good evening to the listeners and to the viewers. So there is a gap in terms of what NSFAS provides and what BITS charges. Now, the reason for that is because if you stay in a BITS res, it comes with many other services, for example, transport, sports, clubs and societies, and additional tutorial support as well. So there is a gap there. However, that's not the issue that we're facing at the moment. We've got about 39,000 out of 600 out of 40,000 students registered. That's about 98% of students. We're in the fourth week of term now. For first years, it's the fourth week of term already. For others, we're in the third week of term. Now, the demands that have been put on the university are the following, and we think that it's a part of a national movement, that it's in solidarity with some of the protests that are happening kind of across the country. But the three demands that came through, and this is, I must emphasize, not from some of the SRC leaders, because we've been working with them to fundraise. So the first is that they want free education for all. And that's that's a great ideal. That's something that I think from 2015, 2016, we said we believe in. But it's not something that the university can carry on its own. The second, in terms of accommodation and tuition fees, is that the university does, all that it can. I mean, we spent 2.1 billion rand last year on student financial aid, scholarships and bursaries. This year, we created something called the WITS Student Registration Assistance Fund, that we put in 20 million rand to help students to register and to pay for accommodation. We also worked with the SRC. We've raised about 6 million rand, which was disbursed this week, to help students to register. The problem here, though, is the students who are protesting at the moment, many of them are students who are not performing well academically. And so while they're saying it's financial exclusion, they're not getting the financial assistance because they are not performing well academically. So if you take NSFAS, for example, most of the students, whose household income is 600,000 or less, would qualify for NSFAS. The problem is if you fail twice, you lose your NSFAS funding. And that's what's happened to a lot of the students. They now owe the university debt because they've lost their funding. And they're not readmitted because they don't qualify for financial funding because of the academic results. And this has resulted in them protesting today.
Yeah, Sharona, if we're speaking about academically excluded students, that's an entirely different conversation. Perhaps want us to focus and delineate students here who are academically still within their course framework. That is to say, they're not academically excluded, and who are on NSFAS at the moment. How many of those students, as a result of their debt, have not been able to register?
So students who are on NSFAS, even if NSFAS hasn't paid us, if they on the NSFAS list, they are allowed to register. So NSFAS, in fact, has been good this year in that they've released their list early of students that they funded. So if they're on the NSFAS list, they will automatically be registered. So that's the first. The second is for those who are doing well academically, that's what this student registration assistance fund is there for. That's what the SRC access fund is there for, to help those who are doing well academically but who may be short financially. We've also made 17 concessions this year. So, for example, students who owe 120,000 rand or less, as long as they make a contribution towards their payment, pay 50% of their debt, or arrange a payment plan with the finance office, we are allowing them to register, provided that they're doing well academically. The list of 17 concessions is on our website, and anyone can kind of have a look at it. I also want to dispel this myth that it's only poor Black African students that are affected. WITS is 77% Black African. So, and like I said, 98% of our students are registered already. We've got postgrad intakes that happen throughout the year, And the extra, you know, few hundred students who register throughout the year are the postgrad students who register in May, July, you know, October, and etc. So that's a myth that it's just poor black, you know, students who are targeted here, or that the university doesn't feel for that. Ideally, we'd like for all students to be fully funded. But as we know, and NSFAS caters for the poorest of the poor, we still have the missing middle problem. But if they're doing well academically, we've managed to assist those. It's those that are repeatedly failing who accumulate debt because, you know, they stay in residences, they rake up those expenses, and then they can't afford it to move forward. But it's they lose their funding because they don't do well academically. So the two are related.
Yeah, but I do think we need to perhaps double-click in on that issue of the shortfall between what the National Student Financial Aid Scheme provides in terms of accommodation and what the on-campus residence fees are, Edwards. A 20,000 rand shortfall is a lot for a student who has absolutely nothing. I was once exactly that student, Sharona, but luckily for me, that shortfall didn't quite exist at the scale it does now. That means a lot must have happened in the last 10 years for that shortfall to be quite that exorbitant. What concessions can the university make specifically around residence accommodation on campus for students who are on NSFAS and who don't have the sort of money to cover that shortfall? It's 20,000 rand at the lowest end, and I'm assuming for students that are in catered reses and who make use of the other amenities that you describe, that shortfall might be in excess of 20,000 rand.
Yeah, but that's exactly, if you are a passing student, even if you have that shortfall, you apply to the BITS Registration Assistance Fund or you apply to the SRCX Access Fund, and if you meet the criteria, the academic criteria, you will receive that funding for that shortfall. But we've got students here, some of them, for example, who failed multiple times. They're there in year 4, 5, 6 when they should be there for a 3-year degree. They're staying in res, they accumulate that debt. They're now sitting with debt of 200,000-300,000 rand. Some of them have completed 2 degrees in the particular group sitting there. Some of them have completed two degrees. They now want to study for a master's degree, but haven't paid off their debt for their undergrad or their honors degrees. So they want to come in for a third degree. The point there is that the university can't accommodate that. At the moment we've got 1.5 billion to 2 billion rand.
Esira shisho, fajota kupasere opowolo kana kupasira ya kweli ochisho. Watu chithana basic mental health first aid course. Haiga njua oshari chamhongi kwa mboka ili iyo, iyo NHP. Watapewa unongo nonseo na kene una okutongorora omadidiriko ugopetameko yenacha nupiakadhi nenge omathidakano opamadhiraviro kuchane omokatiko kumeko Ninge aniranga pamwe nangoe Osho otopewa unongo Ngene una okwea kwa thera Nukwea pa ea bidido Yiri mwonjira Omanga upya kadiboka inauru darara Kuyerere ounji Na hene unokara uishangitha Tarira po epanja yao Yo nhp.com.na Epangono maradura thano Ododina okurandurwa NHP rooted in care for you
Your life, your peace of mind. NHP, we're about you.
Let's listen now to a discussion on job opportunities versus actual jobs.
The Employment and Labour Minister, Nomakhosa Zanameth, will today activate more than 1.5 billion rand in skills development and job creation funding, which is aimed at generating over 30,000 opportunities in Gauteng, as the country battles persistently high joblessness. The intervention comes as new quarterly labor data shows the national unemployment rate easing slightly to 31.4% in the last 3 months of 2025, with around 7.8 million people still out of work. It underscores the scale of the unemployment challenge facing government programs, but the minister's here to tell us about this activation and speak broadly on employment and labor in the country. Minister, thank you so much for the time this morning. Really appreciate it. A marathon week one has certainly seen from yourselves as well. We appreciate it. It's a difficult scenario, though, because as you put it, it's the year of putting South Africa's youth to work. But one must say it's probably going to be very difficult when that youth is still sitting with what is one of the highest unemployment rates we've seen to date.
Yes, good morning to you, Arabile, and your viewers at home. It's quite a very steep hill that one has to climb. This unemployment rate is stubborn. We appreciate the slight decline of a 5 percentage point, but at the same time, we are not just sitting back and watching. We as government, working with our partners in particular, the industry, who are doing all to turn the situation around. As we have heard the president, that we have since experienced in the recent past, some green shoots in the country in terms of the economy that has improved. We are also excited that our UIF through the PIC's investments in the JSE have grown with more than 32 billion rand from last year March up to February this year, putting us at 207 billion rand investment, which is giving us also some ground to maneuver to ensure that we do these interventions as we wait for the labor market to be well capacitated to absorb the labor force.
You know, the difficulty, I suppose, Minister, here, though, is that just last year, if one aggregates the figures, we only created in total 20,000 job opportunities. I know from a quarterly basis, it increases here, decreases there. But if on aggregate, it's only 20,000. And then this is meant to hopefully activate 30,000 job opportunities. One asks the question, what is an opportunity versus an actual job itself? And does this make it long-term? Is it short-term, et cetera? What is the basis under which we're giving these people these job opportunities? And what does it actually mean for our economy?
Okay. I think, let me first explain what is the labor activation program through which we are providing these job opportunities through skills development. Since 2008 and 2009's economic recession, the Department of Employment and Labor started a program to intervene as part of the public employment programs so that there can be job opportunities for our people. We are saying the economy needs to grow in order for us to have sustainable jobs that are created. But as I said earlier on, we can't then sit back and watch when the economy is battling. We know there were many disruptions that happened. One would mention just a few, your COVID-19 pandemic, the issue of the uprising in KZN and Gauteng that happened in 2021, the issue of floods. So there's been a lot, the geopolitics. Some of these things, our government is hard at work in improving on those. We have seen the stabilizing of the electricity through Eskom and ending the load shedding. And also you see DTIC is up and down, ensuring that international trade relations are as strengthened as we are faced by serious pressures across the globe. But sure, we are even expanding in the African continent to ensure that we get the market. Because once we are able then to improve in that front, we will see serious sustainable jobs for our people as the economy grows. So we are intervening through LEP, which is a program that is meant exactly to give an opportunity to government to do something. So it's job opportunities because we are giving skills to these young ones in particular, as we have seen, and you have also said that the youth is the most affected by the unemployment. So it's an intervention from the government front, but it's not only government that must come to the fore in order for us to be able to create opportunities for our citizens to get employment.
Zimbabwe rolls out new HIV prevention drug.
Epworth Sabam health authorities and partners marked the launch of lenacapavir, an injectable HIV prevention drug expected to transform how people protect themselves against the virus. Among the first to receive the injection is Precious Chiwaya, who says the new drug offers longer and more reliable protection, but also some much-needed peace of mind she didn't have before.
I used to take the oral PrEP, but when I went to the clinic, I would only get a month's supply. Sometimes I wouldn't even get any because stocks were low. That was too risky for me, so I've chosen this option, which protects me for 6 months without any issues.
Zimbabwe has made major gains in HIV treatment access, with over 1.3 million people living with the virus and more than 90% of them accessing life-saving antiretroviral treatment. But health officials say new infections remain worryingly high, especially among adolescent girls and young women, underscoring the need for more effective prevention options.
This tells us something important. Prevention must fit into real life. If a health solution is too complicated, too demanding, or too visible, people simply won't use it. That is why innovation in prevention matters. Lenacapava represents a new way of doing things.
Activists say the long-acting injection could be a game changer in lowering new infections.
It promotes adherence. There are people who struggle with daily methods, like oral PrEP, for instance. And so you can imagine if you're able to just get two jabs per year, it really does alter the way we look at things. In terms of HIV incidence or new infections, this is going to play a really huge role in reduction of new infections.
Experts have welcomed this new HIV prevention drug as a breakthrough, but insist that it's not a silver bullet. They say HIV prevention must still rely on medical and behavioral interventions. Despite the emergence of this powerful drug, authorities continue to promote the consistent use of condoms, maintaining fewer partners and open communication with partners as part of their broader fight against HIV. Farai Mwakutuya, CGTN, Harare, Zimbabwe.
Meanwhile, Malians march in show of solidarity in Cuba.
At Cuba's embassy in Mali's capital, locals waved flags and placards condemning the U.S. for imposing harsh economic sanctions on Cubans. They say the sanctions imposed in 1960 harm ordinary Cuban citizens more than political leaders.
We demand that the U.S. government immediately end the blockade imposed on fuel supplies to Cuba, as well as the economic, commercial, and financial blockade.
The event drew former Malian students in Cuba, activists and civil society members, many of whom say their support is rooted in historical ties and shared political ideals between African nations and Cuba.
They say Mali is the poorest country in the world, so why won't they leave us alone so we can develop? That's the question. We cannot remain idle. We cannot remain indifferent. The cause of humanity compels us to step forward, not only as former students in Cuba, but as human beings, as Malians.
Diplomatic representatives welcomed the show of support, describing it as a symbol of enduring friendship between nations of the global south.
I would like to once again thank the many expressions of solidarity received from Mali and from all corners of the world, from governments and socio-political organizations that have voiced their support for Cuba in the face of this new escalation of economic warfare, threats of military intervention, as well as all the humanitarian initiatives that have been undertaken.
While the gathering remained peaceful, observers say such demonstrations reflect growing public engagement in international issues and highlight how global political tensions resonate far beyond their regions of origin. Wanja Mungai, CGTN.
And now for some international news. Let's take a listen to a study on what can be done to improve young people's access to jobs.
The boomer generation have got the triple lock and they've got free prescriptions and they've got... I don't think the social policy is geared enough towards helping young people.
With new figures showing unemployment rising, what can be done to improve young people's access to stable jobs?
So the latest unemployment rate for 16 to 24-year-olds is 16.1%. That's the highest level in more than 10 years. And for some months now, it's been higher than the EU. And you've got companies like a recruitment agency Reed reporting job advertised roles down by 70% compared to 2023. How old are you, Nicole, if you don't mind me asking? So you're 16, and is this something you're worried about?
Yeah, I think a lot of people my age and around my age struggle with finding employment now and also thinking about later in life finding employment.
Right, okay. Gosh, I mean, at 16 you should be living life and loving it, but this is something you're worried about already. Richard?
Look, I mean, Nicole, this is... I had my first job waiting tables as a sort of 16, 17-year-old. I was so shy at that point. My first girlfriend had to go and get the application form for me. But it really transformed...
How things have changed, Richard.
How things have changed. But it transformed, like, my ability to speak to people, to actually go out there and interact with people of different generations. And I think it really provides a sense of work ethic to people and really gets you, you know, to have your own money, to be able to spend your own money. I think it's such an important thing. Like, I was speaking to a little cafe owner in Billericay just last week at Cloud Nine. They're really being squeezed by the combination of business rates going up on one side, and on the other side, the national insurance rises as well, the national insurance tax, which employers have to pay. And the real impact on that has been on part-time and in younger staff, where you didn't have to pay it until you hit quite a high threshold before. Now you've basically got to pay on anybody who's got a part-time job. And it just means that those starter jobs are just totally out of reach for employers now. They're having to either cut back, raise prices. It's one of the reasons inflation stayed higher for longer. But the fact that we've now got higher youth unemployment than most of Europe, it is, you know, we used to look at places like Spain and Italy and Greece and think, gosh, we'll never be like them because we've always had that flexible labour market. We're not overtaxing business for employing young people. And the real worry for me is that they'll knock on long-term consequences for people like yourself. Because I had that job opportunity and it led me to all sorts of different things when I was a teenager. Enabled me to, you know, go and take my first girlfriend on dates and all sorts of things. But also enabled me to, you know, develop all of those soft skills which are so important for employment later in life. So I think the government should really look again at those business rates, particularly hitting the high street firms and those hospitality businesses and those retail firms. You know, Conservatives have said we will have no business rates for any leisure, hospitality or retail firm on under £110,000 a year. That'll be a huge tax cut for a lot of small high street businesses, and I think it's exactly where the country needs to go. We've got to take taxes off business to enable young people to get jobs.
John?
I think it's bleak in the extreme, and I kind of don't want to be the doom monger here, but you look at AI and what is that's going to be doing for graduate entry jobs, and, you know, as Richard said, it's a very difficult climate to be employing young people, and I'd be very interested to see what happens about the kind of minimum wage provision for people that are going straight into jobs as well. It's incredibly tough. And I think that, you know, graduate tax as well, with some people paying an extra 9% on their taxes, or, you know, so that someone who hasn't gone to university is actually much better off than someone who has, who's got a student loan to pay off. I'd love to think that there was this kind of magic thing that you could just do. But, you know, I kind of look back at when.
And with that, we have come to the conclusion after this episode of On the Radar News Analysis. Do stay tuned for the Onkonana Dingi program now, brought to you by Louis Sashimi. Goodbye.